Let's start with our motivation. And very helpful to contemplate karma and its effects, recognizing that whatever happiness or misery we experience is a result of our own actions. And so all the time we're in the process of experiencing the result of previous actions, as we experience happiness, unhappiness, and neutral feeling, on and on and on. And that how we respond to these feelings creates more karma. So usually when there's happy feelings, we cling on to them with attachment. When there's unpleasant feelings, we push them away with anger. And when there's neutral feelings, we kind of space out. So at the same time, we're experiencing the results of actions we did in the past. How we respond to that is creating results that we'll experience in the future. They're creating the causes for those results that we'll experience in the future. So it's important to be aware of how this system of karma and its effects works, because that awareness gives us the ability then to remain steady even when confronted with unpleasant feelings, instead of getting all whacked out about them. And also to be steady when we experience very pleasant feelings, so we don't get overexcited about those. And by keeping our responses to the feelings in moderation, then we have a lot more mental space to engage in virtuous activities, to choose, to make a conscious choice about what is of value and meaning to us, and then to do those things rather than waste our time. So with this kind of awareness about causality, let's generate the bodhicitta, because it is so vast and encompasses so many beings, becomes the cause for so much extended happiness. Let's cultivate that motivation and hold on to it as something really precious and valuable in our lives. And when there's bodhicitta in the mind, then we can engage with joy in whatever activity we're doing. And so to have that kind of joyful feeling inside as we listen to the Buddha's teachings this evening. The name of the first Bhumi? Why? No, they're not free of the afflictive obscurations at the first Bhumi. What are they free of? The acquired afflictions. Yeah. And their delight in generosity. Second one's called?
Stainless.
Why?
Because they're
Yeah, they have stainless ethical conduct even in their dreams. Third one? Luminous. Why? Yeah, what kind of light? So some kind of light appears, maybe to other people who see them, but then not to themselves in meditation, but only afterward. And the fourth, radiant, why? Yeah, they have, well, it's joyous effort, but it's the light of wisdom. Yeah, and so they also have this kind of light appearing to them and on them. Fifth one, indomitable. Why? Yeah, they can't be overcome by the Maras. What are the Maras? Afflictions, death, the polluted aggregates, and external interferences. Yeah. Like Cupid. That's how they westernized this Mara. Okay, and then the sixth one is approaching. Why? They approach. Yeah, they're approaching the qualities of the Buddha. So that's as far as we got, right? So we're on the seventh ground now. Oh, but before we start, you have something and you have something. So you're on.
I'm just a bit worried when but that I can't give very short answer. Very short.
Tell,
So
repeat what the question
the
was.
question was, at what point one received the prophecy about his enlightenment from the Buddha? And I asked it Venerable, and Venerable passed this question back to me, just as Rindava back his homage by Tsongkhapa to Tsongkhapa. So, some kind of. And here's my investigation. In my attempt to find the answer on that question, so by the power of Google, I was turned to a few trusted and some untrusted. I didn't check. I mean, I don't know the sources and don't know teachers, such as Golden Light Sutra, Aryasanghata Sutra, Brief History of Maitreya by Lama Yeshe, and Brief Guide to the Stages and Path of Bodhisattva by Patru Rinpoche, and some. So this trusted one. So, and. I didn't find information that would in detail say on which stage the practitioner is on the path being received his prophecy, what exactly state of mind, but from all descriptions that we can find, it's clear that the state of mind is very powerful, extraordinary compared to the state of ordinary childish beings like us, and endowed with great qualities and enormous amount of merit. And from all I found, I make inference that one can receive the prediction being on the path of accumulation?
Really?
I don't know, probably. And being reborn in some god realm like 33, like in Golden Light Sutra, or in pure lands like Sukhavati. So in Aryasanghata Sutra, here is example of, I thought it's path of accumulation. Maybe I'm wrong, that there is Buddha speaking, talking to Sarvashara, the great Bodhisattva, and he recollecting his cases when he encountered enormous amount of Buddhas and different times and perform incredible actions of generosity, giving everything he had to just everything that would please the Buddhas. And he going on and on like many, many times, many cases. And he's saying that after pleasing all these Buddhas, he received prediction, the prophecy on his enlightenment. But the exact time of enlightenment didn't arrive yet. And it's arrived at some point later. And
Did it talk about the Bodhisattva going to many different pure lands? to make offerings? Or what was
probably that what means probably, but yeah. There is some other
okay.
One source saying that too. I think it's from Pali tradition. According to the Buddha, in order to become a full bodhisattva, there is four prerequisites, and third and fourth one, that individual must receive the prediction of fulfillment of their aspiration at the foot of a living Buddha. So mm-hmm. It's one, the cases. So when someone go into Pure Lands, it's not the same, right? Or can we say that this is...
Well, you know, if you mix traditions, because the, you know, in the Pali tradition, they don't talk about like Sukhavati and mm-hmm. so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I discovered too, right?
Yeah. So they would be talking only about the wheel-turning Buddhas who would... Mm-hmm. Give the prediction.
So I think in Aryasanghata Sutra there is alive Buddhas. He encountered and give them, make an enormous amount of, you know, perform an enormous generosity to them. And in Golden Light Sutra, there is three, the prophecy mentioned three times, but the reason why they receive a prediction mentioned only twice in two chapters. First one in chapter 15, chapter on the prophecy of the 10,000 sons of gods, and it's saying, to make it shorter, as soon as they heard the prophecy of these three sublime beings, so there is a story here that they heard about prediction on to other guys. And by hearing this, mm-hmm. their mind become, they generate great reverence and faith in this King of Glory, Glorious Sutra, the Sublime Golden Light, it means in Dharma, that they heard. And immediately they were endowed with pristine minds like stainless, flawless lapis. They became endowed with minds like the sky, lucid, pure, exceedingly vast and expansive. They became possessed of an inconceivable mass of merit. And a bit later, by the power of the gathering of the merit of hearing this Dharma teaching and by the power of previous resolve, the 10,000 sons of gods such as Jvalananta Ratajaraja have now attained the stage of prophecy to peerless and perfect enlightenment. Furthermore, because they have listened to these Dharma teachings with instant joy, aspiration, supreme joy, and reverence, they have all received prophecies and names. So there's a very deep... state of mind, like joyous, you know, great reverence, aspiration, and faith, and so on. And that does mean they you know, can just sit and enjoy whatever they could enjoy and don't go further on the path. I will conclude maybe with a statement that one teacher nowadays making in his work, about going to such pure lands like Sukhavati, that mm-hmm. we know from stages on the Bodhisattva path that on the great stage of path accumulation, practitioner gain super knowledges by which he can actually travel to different pure lands. And probably it's the case when, okay,
that's a great path of
by sustain meditative concentration during daily activity as a way of gaining the miraculous powers such as super knowledges by manifesting various miraculous powers on the greater path of accumulation. It's by Patru Rinpoche. We can travel miraculously to the fields where Buddhas actually reside. There we can receive and master countless hundreds and thousands of Dharma teachings.
Okay.
And I think it's maybe the case where they also can receive the prophecy.
Yeah, that would be on the great path of accumulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, to conclude, sorry for so long. In his work, The Way of the Bodhisattva, someone like Peter della Santina saying, this event of the articulation of the vow and the reception of the prediction functions more as a confirmation of his resolve and progress toward Buddhahood than as an instrumental cause of his enlightenment. It is perhaps for this reason that they have received somewhat less attention than the other steps of the way of the Bodhisattva within the living Mahayana tradition. In fact, we do have a formalization of the articulation of the vow and reception of the prediction in the Mahayana tradition.
Yeah.
This function is a kind of imitation of the events of the career of the Bodhisattva. Today, one who wants to follow the Bodhisattva path could articulate the vow before living spiritual master and receive from him the prediction of Buddhahood. So I was lucky enough to receive Bodhisattva vows from His Holiness, but I never asked him about predictions, so I don't know. Maybe I should.
Well, actually, until we generate spontaneous bodhicitta, we're not receiving the actual Bodhisattva vow. We're receiving a similitude. So, yeah. Okay, so still to be determined, but you did some good research there. We have some idea about what's going on with the Bodhisattva at that time. Yeah. So lots of merit, very strong aspiration, seeing a lot of Buddhas. I know at the great stage of path accumulation, you can also receive teachings from statues. So, yeah. But yeah, you can sit here and I'll teach you. yeah. And they say also at that path that you can remember all the teachings you've ever heard. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Okay, so thank you very much. Yeah. And if anybody else comes across more information on this. Yeah. And did you have any success?
Well, I have a guess. So in verse 441, Nagarjuna is saying that the first ground bodhisattvas have been born into the Tathagata family. And so I asked, didn't they become a child of the lineage on when they entered the path of accumulation with uncontrived bodhicitta or spontaneous bodhicitta? And I looked in the liberation in the palm of your hand, and what's interesting is that the first two benefits of developing uncontrived bodhicitta or spontaneous bodhicitta is one is that you become a child of the lineage, and the second is that you surpass hearers and solitary realizers in terms of lineage. And what's interesting about both of those is that actually
Nagarjuna puts them much later on the path.
Yeah, that, and Chandrakirti and others talk about the first ground bodhisattva surpasses the hearers and solitary realizer arhats in terms of their lineage on the first ground, but then doesn't surpass their knowledge until the seventh ground. And so I thought, well, maybe those first two, and I didn't go further, but maybe those first two are giving the name of the result to the cause that, you know, although they're getting closer to becoming a first ground bodhisattva, which would mean that, like you mentioned 2 weeks ago, that they are definite then to accomplish the result of their path or their vehicle, that they're getting closer. But still, I think you also mentioned that, you know, on that first level of the path of accumulation, one can relinquish their mind of enlightenment, so it becomes definite on the path of seeing. So that's what I found about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite interesting, that thing of becoming the child of the Buddha and entering the lineage. As we continue on here, Kenzo Rinpoche talks about that. Nagarjuna actually places those much later than, you know, your first time of generating spontaneous bodhicitta. So, yeah, maybe they gave the name of the result to the cause. Maybe they, I don't know.
The other interesting thing is that I, at least in my memory, and I didn't check this, but I don't remember the benefits of developing bodhicitta being described in that same way in the Lam Rim Chimo, and I still have to check that.
Well, that list of, you know, those
the
benefits.
Ten? Yeah. Are they there?
Well, I mean, I hear it again and again. I don't know if it's in the Longam Chenmo. I would imagine so.
But I don't remember it there.
Yeah. Because they always have the benefits of the bodhicitta somewhere so that you get encouraged. Okay. Well, good questions and no decisive conclusions, but a lot more to think about. So that's good. That's good. So if somebody gets a prediction, please tell the rest of us. But you're not also, you're also not supposed to tell the things you've attained out loud, only to, you know, special people. Okay, shall we continue on? So we're at verse 453. So the seventh is the far advanced, because the number of excellent qualities has advanced far. Since on this ground they enter moment by moment into the equipoise of cessation. Through the maturation of this ground, they become the powerful ruler of the celestials. They become a great leader of the Janakacharyas, knowing the realization of the Arya's Four Truths. Okay, so it's called far advanced, yeah, because before, remember with the fifth ground, when we, and the sixth ground, we were hearing about how their concentration was vastly improved and they can go in and out of different concentrations more easily and more quickly. Yeah, on the fifth, but then on the sixth, it was combined with wisdom, and so the wisdom got stronger. So here on the seventh, yeah, they can enter into and arise from the unique absorption in cessation. So remember last time we talked about the absorption is cessation? The idea is that here cessation means emptiness, okay? So there was common and uncommon, common and unique absorption into cessation, and two ways of seeing that. The common one was seeing it, well, one way was the common was how you absorb into emptiness on the first through seven bhumis, and the unique one was from the eighth to tenth. And then the other way of saying it was that the common one was according to the lower view, the lower school's view, probably of emptiness, and the unique one was the Prasangika system. So here, I think it must be the Prasangika system, yeah, because you can't become an Arya. You can't even attain the path of preparation without having the Prasangika view of emptiness. Okay, so they can enter into and arise from this unique absorption of cessation very, very quickly. And when you think about it, you know, that means they can go into, you know, very profound realization of emptiness and come out of it and deal with the conventional world in a very easy way, you know, which I would think would be very, very difficult, you know, because the realization of emptiness completely shatters the way you normally look at the world. And so to go into emptiness and then come out and like have all this appearance of true existence hit you again, even though you're seeing it as illusory, it seems like it would be difficult. But they apparently can handle it and, you know, can go in and out very easily, which really shows the flexibility of their mind and the depth of the realization. And this is due to their practice of the perfection of skillful means, which is the perfection that is becomes unsurpassed on this particular ground. Okay, so they become more and more adept. Their intelligence is sharper. They can go in and out of the absorption of cessation very easily, very you know, they have great agility in their meditation. Okay? So Kenzo Rinpoche made the analogy of like a skilled cyclist who does not wobble or become unsteady however fast they go. Yeah, so that bodhisattva in their meditation on emptiness is like that. Okay, now here we get into something interesting, what we were just talking. Yep.
What's the difference between realization of emptiness and understanding emptiness?
Okay. When we use the term realization, there's two types of realization. One is a realization by an inferential cognizer. The other is a direct non-conceptual cognizer. The latter one is when you're seeing emptiness directly. The first one is you're realizing it through an inference. Okay, those are both considered realizations of emptiness. But just because you understand the syllogism, for example, you know, the I is empty of inherent existence because it's dependent arising, and just because you know the words and you can kind of say a little bit about what they mean, that doesn't mean you've realized the syllogism, and it doesn't mean that you've realized emptiness. So in our understanding of emptiness, we start out with a wrong cognizer because we usually grasp true existence. As we study and contemplate emptiness more, then we go from there into doubt. But here it's a doubt more inclined towards the correct view, but still you're not very sure. From there you go into a correct assumption. So there you've kind of understood the syllogism, you've understood the various reasonings about emptiness, but it hasn't, you don't really get it in your heart. It hasn't had a real strong impact on you. When you have an inferential cognizer of emptiness, then you have, it really strongly impacts you, and especially with a direct non-conceptual realization.
What's an inferential cognizer?
When you've realized it through inference, what I was just saying, but that syllogism, or any of the different reasonings that were taught. You know, there's a number of different reasonings. So you understand those reasonings. You realize emptiness because you completely understand the reasonings in such a way that you no longer have any doubt, any equivocation, any anything. You know, you're completely certain. Okay? So when they talk of how we develop this, you know, we have to start out at the lower levels, and we have to listen to teachings, and we have to think about the teachings and, you know, discuss them a lot and, you know, reflect on them, and this is where debate comes in and so on. So it's not a quick, cheap, and easy process. Okay? It takes a while. Okay, so the Arya Bodhisattvas outshine hearers and solitary realizers in two ways. Okay, so here's Arya Bodhisattvas, and the word is outshine here. Okay, so once on the first ground and again on the seventh ground. So on the first ground, they outshine them through their lineage. So this is one of the ones that you say comes in the benefits of bodhicitta. Yeah, either that or, you know, when it's attributed to that, but maybe they, you know, they're putting some of the later results earlier. You know, that could be something like that. Okay, so on the first ground, they outshine the hearer and solitary realizer arhats in terms of their lineage. Okay, because in addition to having the wisdom realizing that directly perceives emptiness, they have the special practice, the method aspect of bodhicitta. Yeah, so that's a big difference between the Arya Bodhisattvas and the hearer and solitary realizer arhats even. or Aryas, is that the bodhisattvas have this whole collection of merit that's been going on, and, you know, a very strong practice of method, whereas the followers in the here and solitary realizer vehicles don't have that. Yeah, the mind isn't sustained and supported by that kind of merit and that kind of practice of method. Okay, so then they go into this description that they always have of, okay, like, you have the monarch and the monarch's child, and then you have the ministers, yeah? Okay, so the monarch, clearly, you know, that's in the analogy there is like the Buddha. The monarch's children are going to become the monarchs at some point, okay? When they're born, they don't have, you know, all that wisdom and all that learning and stuff, but they're in the lineage to become the monarch. The ministers, on the other hand, will never become the monarch, you know, because they weren't born into that lineage. But the ministers have a great deal of knowledge and can do a great deal. Okay? So the monarch is like the Buddha. The first ground bodhisattvas are like the monarch's child, the prince or princess, when they're very small. Okay? And the ministers are like the fundamental vehicle arhats. Okay? So the little kid, the little prince and princesses, you know, they don't know as much as the ministers, you know, but they're sooner or later going to become the monarch, okay? Whereas the ministers, the arhats, fundamental vehicle arhats, they have eliminated all the afflictive obscurations. The first ground bodhisattvas haven't, but those first ground bodhisattvas will definitely become Buddhas, like the prince and princess will become the monarch, but the minister never will become the Buddha. I mean, never will become the monarch. Okay, is that clear? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, so on the first ground, they outshine them through their lineage, okay? Because they have not only the wisdom realizing emptiness, which the arhats have, but also they have the special practice of method and all this merit they've accumulated, which the ministers don't have. So even though they're still little kids, they haven't eliminated all the afflictive obscurations like the ministers, the arhats have, they still outshine them. Okay? So this is due to their royal lineage, which surpasses the lineage of the ministers. Okay? So this is if you attribute a lot to blood relations. I mean, these analogies come from a society like that. Okay? Okay. So the first ground bodhisattvas are of the Tathagata lineage, and they're on their way to awakening. Okay? So I think that's clear. Then on the seventh ground, the bodhisattvas outshine the fundamental vehicle arhats through the power of their wisdom. Yeah. So when they were first ground bodhisattvas, it was only through the power of their lineage. Yeah. Now it's the power of their wisdom, because they can enter into and arise from meditation on emptiness in a very brief moment. Now, yeah, so they say, you know, Khunsa Rinpoche explains that this is extremely difficult to do, because when you're in meditative equipoise and emptiness, the mind and emptiness are fused. They say they become like one taste, like water poured into water. Okay, so to come out of that is, you know, must be really something. Okay. So they can go back and forth between cognizing ultimate truth non-dualistically and conventional truths dualistically. So the seventh crown bodhisattvas, they're like the monarch's child who is in college. Yeah, they're not the babies anymore. They know something. Yeah, they're going to soon become like the monarch. Okay, maybe not just in college, maybe they're in grad school. Okay, so, you know, they're not the babies. They're educated, intelligent. They are on their way. Okay, and so just like the seventh ground, grounders, they're very close to the eighth ground. You know, the eighth ground is really momentous because at that time they have eliminated all the afflictive obscurations, just like the fundamental vehicle arhats. Okay? Plus they have the special practice of method and so on. Okay? So the ripening result was to take birth as a king of the gods in the heaven of controlling others' emanations. So that's one of the upper desire realm gods. God realms, I can't remember which number, maybe the fifth. Okay, so they have special wisdom, understanding the four truths, the 37 aids to awakening, and the 12 links, because remember back on the 4th, 5th, and 6th, they gained special wisdoms about that. So here now they, you know, really have very good wisdom, and they have the perfection of method, yeah, or of skillful means that supports that. And as a result of these qualities and their powerful intelligence, they become great leaders among the knowledgeable teachers. So that word in the third line of 454, jhana acharyas, jhana means wisdom, acharya means instructor or teacher. So that's what it's referring to. They become a great leader of those teachers. And for good reason, you know? I mean, they're quite realized and talented. Then 455 and 56, the eighth is the youth's ground, the immovable, because free of conceptions, they are unshakable. The range of their physical, verbal, and mental activities is inconceivable. Through the maturation of this ground, they become a Brahma who rules 1,000 worlds. They are unsurpassed by the hearers and solitary realizers in determining the meaning of the Dharma. Okay. So, these bodhisattvas, they're immovable, yeah? Because they can't be moved by the apprehension of signs. Whenever you hear that thing of signs, like apprehending signs or grasping signs, it means grasping at true existence. Okay. So they can't be moved by that kind of grasping because they've eliminated it completely from their mind stream so that it can never arise again. So basta, finito. Yeah. So ordinary beings and other bodhisattvas who haven't abandoned this grasping are not able to understand the range of the physical, verbal, and mental activities of these particular aryas of the eighth bhumi. I mean, it's just inconceivable. Just think about it for a minute, yeah? Think about, you know, imagine you have no anger so that you never, ever at all, no matter what somebody says, no matter what horrible thing they do to you or say to you, it never bothers you. Yeah, your mental peace is that steady, you never get angry. Yeah? So you can see why they say it's difficult for ordinary people to understand the eighth ground bodhisattvas. Yeah? Because it's like, oh my goodness, what would that feel like? Yeah? What in the world would that feel like? And plus, of course, you know, when you don't get angry like other people do, and you don't have attachment like other people do, then people are going to call you weirdo and all kinds of names. And that, too, is not going to faze you. Yeah? So even when they call you names because they don't understand the exalted qualities of your mind, you don't care. And it's not a dismissive, well, I don't care about you, buddy. But it's a thing of real compassion for the other person. And so no matter how much chocolate cake they put in front of you, whatever your version of chocolate cake is, whatever it is that you cling on to and crave and want, yeah. We had some people volunteer a few things a few weeks ago, remember? Yeah? So no matter how much you crave that and want that and need that, actually, there's no how much you craved it, wanted it, needed it before, when you're an Arya Bodhisattva, that stuff doesn't interest you anymore. Okay? You don't need certificates. You don't need praise. You don't need people telling you how wonderful you are and how much they love you and how unique and creative you are. Yeah. All that stuff just doesn't mean anything to you. You're not attached to it. Yeah. I mean, you rejoice when other people have virtuous states of mind, you know, and praise you because they have a virtuous state of mind. But in terms of yourself, yeah. So what would that be like? You know, think of that for a minute. What would that be? Can you even grasp what that would be like? And especially if you see now, like, how bound we are to our needs and our wants and our cravings, and we can't do without them. And how bound we are to our anger and our grudges and our resentment. We're not going to give them up for anything. And then think of what would it be like to not have that in your mind at all. Imagine how much energy you would have. Yeah? Time, energy, happiness, delight, connection. Okay? So then you start to see why, you know, I mean, it's hard for us to even imagine what that would be like. And these are just some of the rudimentary qualities of these bodhisattvas. Yeah? So then you begin to understand why it says that ordinary beings can't even begin to fathom their qualities. Yeah? In fact, we might think of their qualities and diss them. Like, oh, come on, you know, they're just saying that. I don't think anybody can really be like that. Meaning, I can't be like that. And I don't want to think anybody's better than me. So I get out of that by saying nobody can be like that. We do that sometimes, don't we? Yeah.
A stage where you'd be able to go into the hell realm and stay there as long as necessary to...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, probably before some of the bodhisattvas can do that, but definitely eighth ground, you go in the hell realms, no sweat. Even the hot hells, yeah, no problem. So the eighth grounders, you know, when it says free of conception, they are unshakable. They're the perfection that they specialize in is unshakable resolve. That's the eighth ground one. Okay? And so, like I was saying before, some people translate it as prayers, the perfection of prayers. Some people, the perfection of vows. I don't think it's either of those are such good translation, especially prayers. It's not like you just hang out all day and say, may this happen and may that happen. You know, these are unshakable resolves. You are like completely there, completely determined, unshakable, immovable. That's why it's the name of the ground. This is Nagarjuna describing it based on the Sutra of the Ten Grounds. Okay, so I think the Buddhists probably spoke the sutra, or one of the other Buddhists did. Okay, but the ranking is determined by your level of realization and the kinds of virtuous qualities you have. It's not done by the Electoral College. You know, nobody votes you into these different grounds. So you can't accuse, you know, there of being corruption in the election or anything like that. And because it's your own internal qualities, you can't say, you know, it's not fair. Somebody didn't, you know, they didn't read my application correctly, because it's completely an internal affair to you. Nobody else puts you in those stages. It's due to your own realization. Okay. Oh, we could do some really good skits, couldn't we? And then when we think, you know, maybe some of them keep the same behavior, you know, the habitual behavior, then, yes. You know. Anyway, I won't go there. Okay, so the ripening aspect result on this eighth ground is you become a great Brahma king of the thousand worlds. Okay, so remember, one world is one system of Mount Meru with the four continents and eight subcontinents and those things. So a thousand of those. And by having that kind of position, then you can do a lot of beneficial actions for sentient beings. And heroes and solitary realizers, arhats, cannot surpass these bodhisattvas in analyzing, understanding, and explaining the meaning of the Dharma. Okay, so that's because these bodhisattvas now have eliminated the afflictive obscurations in this, just as the fundamental vehicle arhats have. So previously, because they hadn't eliminated all those, the arhats may have been able to surpass them in analyzing emptiness, because they always say the bodhisattvas are superior in that. But, you know, talking about it from personal experience, prior to the eighth bhumi, the arhats could surpass the bodhisattvas on that, but not anymore. Okay, so, so the eighth ground bodhisattvas and the fundamental vehicle arhats are no different in terms of having eliminated the afflictive obscurations. What constitutes afflictive obscurations? The afflictions, their seeds, and the polluted karma that causes rebirth. Okay. But these eighth grounders differ from the arhats from the viewpoint of the method, okay? Because the arhats don't have the exceptional factors of the method side that bodhisattvas do. So they don't have the skillful means of the seventh ground bodhisattva. They don't have these unshakable resolves of the eighth ground bodhisattva. Yeah. So in order, and they don't actually, you know, have any of the perfections, because although the arhats may practice generosity, ethical conduct, and so on, And even if they seal it by a realization of emptiness and dependent arising, they haven't done these practices motivated by bodhicitta. So they haven't become the actual perfections yet. Okay, so let's say that you've become an arhat, a fundamental vehicle arhat. You've gone through the five paths. You've become an arhat. And then you say, oh, actually, I want to become a Buddha now. Yeah, so what do you do? Okay, you've been in your meditative equipoise for a while. The Buddha came and, you know, shook you and said, wake up. There's sentient beings suffering, and you haven't actualized all your potential yet. And so you go, oh, yeah, okay. Huh? And you come out of your meditative equipoise. Actually, I shouldn't joke about the arhats like that. They're quite realized beings to be respected. Anyway, they wake up out of their meditation. And now they generate bodhicitta. They want to become Buddhas. Yeah. But just because their wisdom is equivalent to the eighth ground bodhisattva doesn't mean they enter the bodhisattva path on the eighth ground. Rather, they have to go all the way back to the beginning, to the path of accumulation, because they're just freshly generating spontaneous bodhicitta. And then on the path of accumulation, even though they're more advanced than the fresh initial bodhisattvas in terms of their wisdom, they're creating all this merit just like these bodhisattvas on the path of accumulation. Okay? Then when they have enough merit, yeah, they already have the wisdom side, then they go to the path of preparation, accumulate much, much more merit. Yeah, when they have that merit, you know, accumulated, still their wisdom isn't improving. I'm not improving, but they're not getting stronger wisdom, but it's the merit that then boosts them up to the path of seeing. Okay, for the fresh bodhisattvas, it's your realization of emptiness plus the merit that boosts you up to the next level. But for the arhats, you know, since they've already realized a level comparable to the eighth ground in terms of wisdom, they have to go through all the merit there. So they enter the path of seeing, first bhumi, second bhumi, all the way up, accumulating merit until the eighth ground. So that's two countless great eons of merit. Yeah. So when those arhats go back and start over, they spend two countless great eons accumulating merit, approximately. Yeah. So probably a little shorter because they already have the wisdom aspect of the path down. Yeah. They have that part, so it's probably a little bit shorter, but still a lot of merit, okay? Then when they have the eighth bhumi, then they're kind of equal to the fresh bodhisattvas. Yeah.
So I've heard that it takes longer if you become an arhat and then do all of that accumulation of merit. Is that because they spent this time just chilling in their emptiness meditation?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they spend a long time there. So then they have to come back. Yeah. To bodhisattva path of accumulation. So that's why they encourage us to start with the bodhisattva path directly, rather than first accomplish the arhat's path and then come back and do the bodhisattva's one.
Would you be like the adults going for night school?
Like, who would be?
The arhats that's now come, the fundamental vehicle arhats that's now coming back, starting over from the bodhisattva vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe in that way. They already got their degree, but they're coming back and doing some night school to catch up. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So at the eighth ground, the arhats who have come up through the paths again now have mm-hmm. matched the eighth ground bodhisattvas. But the eighth ground bodhisattvas have still got a little bit, I mean, they've been doing all of this different reasonings to come to this.
Yeah. These I would imagine that in those two countless great eons, I mean, the arhats have also been meditating on emptiness. So I imagine they would have learned the other reasonings
as well.
Yeah, during that time as well. Yeah. But then all of the eighth ground bodhisattvas, they all still have to eliminate the cognitive obscurations that prevent omniscience, or another way to say it, prevent seeing the two truths simultaneously.
In that verse about the eighth ground,
yeah, about the youth thing, I was wondering that too. Unless it's like, you know, because this is the first ground where there are pure ground bodhisattva. So maybe it's like, whoopee, you know, I'm done with all that stuff. And I'm, you know, I'm at the beginning of the pure ground now, something. That's the only thing I could think of too, but that caught my eye and I didn't see an explanation for it. Okay, but maybe because of that. Okay, at the eighth ground, so it's the perfection of method there. Yeah, method. Ninth ground is power. Yeah, so method on the eighth ground. And so they have... they accomplish something called the 10 controls. So if for those of you who are control freaks, you really want to get the eighth ground bodhisattva, become an eighth ground bodhisattva, okay? Because here they can control different things, like their lifespan, the requisites they get, their rebirth. So there's a lot of things, because you've eliminated the afflictive obscurations, that you now have power over and control over. That would think, the ninth one is the one of power. You would think that control would come there. Yeah, and this one is method. Let me check that, because it sounds like it would go more with the next one, the one on power. Okay, then the ninth. Okay, so the ninth, like a regency, is called excellent intelligence. Since by attaining true awareness, these bodhisattvas have excellent understanding on this ground. Through the maturation of this ground, they become the lord of a million worlds. They are unsurpassed by arhats and such regarding qualms in the minds of others. So as they are close to Buddhahood, the ninth grounders are like, you know, they're like the prince or princess ready to be, you know, they're getting really close to being crowned. Okay. They excel in what's called the four specific perfect understandings, which are the Dharma, yeah, the actual words, its meaning, and confidence or eloquence in expounding the Dharma. Yeah, so while these four perfect understandings aren't the same as the Buddha's, they bear a great similitude. Okay, so they're called excellent intelligence, yeah, because of this. So these excellent understandings, they understand the Dharma. Now, he didn't explain it, you know, and it says Dharma, its words, its meaning. Well, isn't that all understanding the Dharma? So I was thinking, maybe understand, this is just my guess, that maybe understanding the Dharma means being able to differentiate what exists and what doesn't exist, what is a correct view and what isn't a correct view, you know, having some kind of speciality in that. And, you know, what is a subtle obscuration? What is an afflictive obscuration? Maybe something like that. I don't know. I mean, they probably have understood this before, but they really excel in understanding this. They understand the words of the Dharma and the meaning. So we always hear these expressions, the words and the meaning. So, you know, at the beginning, and we can see ourselves when we're learning, we're just trying to understand what the words are. Yeah? And get some words and maybe a few different definitions. And how do the words, you know, fit together to form a concept? What is the actual concept? And then the understand the meaning. I think it means not just intellectually understanding the meaning, but actually realizing it. Okay? And then they have confidence or eloquence in expounding the Dharma. Yeah? So when they come up, they're not like me, they have to have their notes here, and, you know, I'm reading my notes, and I wrote them in pencil, and they aren't very clear, and my writing's too small, and I can't figure out what I wrote. You know, so not like that. So for these bodhisattvas, it's just, it's there and it comes out, you know. Yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, sometimes you hear teachers who are like that. It's just like, you know, they're just kind of, you know, like I would say, oh, you know, I walked down the hill today and I saw the snow and the sky was blue. And, you know, they would be talking about these profound topics, you know, that they've realized in their minds just like that. You know, that's how easy it kind of comes out. Yeah, because it's so integrated. Okay. And then when these people ask bodhisattvas questions, no, when people ask these bodhisattvas questions, I knew something was wrong. The bodhisattvas are able to reply correctly without mistakes or contradictions between the explicit and implicit meanings. Okay, so the explicit is what you can readily see the sutras talking about. The implicit is what it's also explaining implicitly. They can explain it without, you know, with perfectly differentiating explicit and implicit meanings, and without confusing earlier and later statements and contradicting themselves and saying, oh, you know, gee, did I say that before? Well, actually, that wasn't correct. This is, you know, scratch that out, erase the tape, don't transcribe that part because I made a big boo-boo. You know, they don't have that problem, okay? It just flows, okay? So they're extremely capable of accomplishing the aims of sentient beings by being able to resolve their qualms and their doubts, and in being able to teach them according to their predisposition or their dispositions, their thoughts and their interests. Okay, and so in this respect, these bodhisattvas can't be surpassed by others. So it's interesting, we see here, you know, on different bodhisattva grounds, the word they can't be surpassed by, you know, and so there's, you know, really emphasizing here the special qualities of these bodhisattvas. So, you know, thinking about, first the seventh ground, which is where it's skillful means, and this ninth ground where it's the perfection of power, where you also have great intelligence. It was making me think, you know, how important those kind of qualities are, because if we don't have them, we may have a very sincere wish to benefit, but we don't know what to do to benefit somebody. And so we miss a lot of opportunities. You know, if you have clairvoyant powers, if you have very, you know, perfected skillful means and perfected power and so forth like that, then, whoever you're with, you can kind of, not kind of, but you can clearly see what they need at that time and know what to say to them that is really going to help them and benefit them on the path. And I was thinking, so often we want to help, but we don't know really what to do. Yeah, so we take a stab in the dark and we teach somebody something, thinking that, and maybe even that person requests a particular teaching, and we think, oh, well, they request it, so I should give it. But actually, it's not the thing that's best for the person. Yeah. And so we miss the opportunity to really give them what they need at that time. And in addition, we may give them what they don't need, such that maybe they become afraid of the Dharma, they become hesitant, they lose their confidence, something like that. Yeah. So like even, teaching these grounds, why do we study these grounds? It's not only a roadmap, which is good and effective, but it's also to inspire us to see that what we can become. But there's some people whose minds work such that when they hear something really good, instead of rejoicing and saying, I'm so glad other beings are like that, and wow, this gives me a vision of what I can become, they respond by, that's just too difficult, I can't do it, I give up. Yeah? Do you see yourself sometimes respond to things when you hear very wonderful things instead of feeling like, gee, maybe I can do it? We just say, forget it. Yeah? So, so this is really why you need to have a lot of skill. When you're teaching, and why these high level bodhisattvas have that skill. Yeah. Because you don't want to accidentally make somebody so discouraged that they just, give up. That wouldn't be too good, would it? Okay, shall I see if I can read some of my notes here? That one I want to check. A mental body. Okay. Yeah, okay. So then, before, remember, we were talking about the mental body. And it's interesting, in Gyulama, the Sublime Continuum, in the teachings I received on Gyulama, it sounded like at the path of seeing, kind of all the Aryas got the mental body, but I heard another teaching later that said that the sharp faculty bodhisattvas have the mental body at the path of seeing, and all the rest of the bodhisattvas definitely have it by the eighth ground. Okay? And also the fundamental vehicle arhats have a mental body. So what is a mental body? Okay, so it is caused, its cause is the latencies of ignorance, so that's a cognitive obscuration, and unpolluted karma. So those, you can see why at the pure ground bodhisattvas and the arhats, they all have the cognitive obscuration, so they have the latency of ignorance. And at that time, they only have unpolluted karma because they've eliminated all the afflictions. So definitely by the eighth bhumi. So it's taken, when you take the mental body is taken with the intention, a strong intention, that is supported by very fervent, a very fervent aspiration to have a mental body and by the force of compassion. And so when the bodhisattvas have this mental body and they can take it, it can appear like the body of an ordinary being. Yeah, it looks like a flesh and blood body. And they deliberately appear that way in order to benefit ordinary beings with those kind of bodies, okay? And those bodies look like they experience birth, aging, sickness, and death. But they don't experience them. Those Aryas don't experience them under the influence of afflictions and karma. Okay, so actually I think in terms of the fundamental vehicle arhats, when they have a mental body, they wouldn't appear back in samsara until they re-entered the bodhisattva path, but they would stay in their mental body in very deep meditative equipoise on emptiness. Yeah, but the bodhisattvas would appear back in samsara in order to benefit sentient beings. So there's this question, do bodhisattvas take rebirth in samsara? Okay, this question comes up. Okay, so here's some things that kind of relate to what we've been discussing with Jeffrey. At the path of seeing, bodhisattvas create only unpolluted karma. So while they may have a manifest moment of ignorance or a manifest moment of attachment or something, they don't create any karma by that. That's when they're before they become, when they're Aryas, but they're not pure ground bodhisattvas yet. Okay? So they have afflictions. Usually when we talk about afflictions, the afflictions disturb the tranquility of mind. That's the meaning of affliction. They disturb the mental peace. But these Arya, from path of seeing until eighth bhumi, they have afflictions, but their afflictions don't really function like afflictions because they don't disturb the tranquility of those bodhisattvas' minds. Okay? So that gives us a little bit more on, grounds 1 to 7. They have afflictions. They may manifest for a moment, but they're not strong enough to create polluted karma. And definitely not the karma that causes rebirth, because they abandoned creating that way back on the path of preparation. And even if the afflictions manifest for a moment, they don't disturb their tranquility. Okay, and so again, sharp faculty bodhisattvas can get this mental body path accumulation. But all bodhisattvas have it by the eighth ground. Okay. So then the ninth. Yeah, we were talking about the ninth, right? Yeah, sharp faculty bodhisattvas can get the mental body at the path of seeing. Yeah?
So this mental body is, the Buddha doesn't have this, right?
The Buddha has the enjoyment body and the emanation body. But this mental body is something that the bodhisattvas have. It's kind of like a preparation for getting the two form bodies of the Buddha.
They appear to sentient beings as a real body.
Yeah.
And the same emanation bodies would also, right?
Yeah.
Appear doesn't just mean visual, right? It means to any of our senses. Would that mean to any of our senses?
Yeah.
Like tactile and all?
Yeah, right, yeah. So these beings would still go to the doctor. If they had surgery, you would still see a liver. Yeah. But, from their side, this is all an appearance to benefit sentient beings.
So you talk about in the eighth and ninth grounds, either they're the lord of 1,000 worlds or a million worlds. Does this mean they also could take on multiple emanations than it simultaneously?
Yeah.
Without any trouble?
Yeah.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah, so it isn't like they just get one mental body, you know. No, they can manifest many, many different kinds of bodies all over the place. You know, because remember when we talked about, oh, I don't know if you were here when we talked about the 12 sets of good qualities. One of them was being able to manifest and send bodies to so many pure lands to receive teachings from Buddhas and so on. So from path of seeing onward, they can manifest many bodies. Okay, so the ninth ground bodhisattva is very good at answering questions. We need one to come here. And we, you know, we have many unanswered questions. Okay, and so, you know, I mean, that would be, what an incredible talent that must be, to really be able to explain things in such a way that you resolve people's doubts and qualms so that they can just go ahead and practice. Okay, and you can also teach in accordance with their dispositions, so you know whether to teach them Mahayana or a fundamental vehicle, you know what level on the path to teach them. You know what they're interested in, you know what kind of examples to give them, you know, whether your examples should be based on motorcycles or based on knitting, you know, because your ability to communicate with sentient beings will vary vastly, you know, according to the examples that you give. I mean, I remember when, you know, because when I started, everybody was just, they were just translating the Tibetan texts, and they would give us these examples from Tibetan society, and we're all going, like, we don't get the examples. The points, maybe we can understand a little bit, but the examples were more difficult instead of it being the other way around. Okay, now we just have a few minutes, and the 10th ground is going to take a little bit more than a few minutes. So let's pause here. Yeah.
I was wondering about the one ground where they don't really have any attachment or anger, and they would seem so different.
Mm-hmm.
What really came to mind strongly was that movie Being There, and then just thinking of people I've met in my life when they were children who were like, kind of different or like savant, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if it seems like, would they know? Like, those people don't, they seem like they don't have some of these afflictions, but they also don't seem like they have the wisdom to fit in. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have no idea, yeah. You know, to talk about the children that are like that. Maybe, maybe not. I really don't know. Mm. Yeah, it could be and it could not be. Yeah, and especially with any individual, you know, we don't really know if they're high-level bodhisattvas or if they have a certain appearance due to karma. Yeah, or due to some other kind of factor. Just one other point. But sometimes when you meet the young Rinpoche, some of them are just appear like any other kid, you know. But some of the young Rinpoches, when they're really young, there's something different about them. Yeah. I don't know that you would say they wouldn't fit in. I mean, definitely not with American kids. But some of them do, yeah. But yeah, there's some special quality. But then other ones, they just seem like regular kids. Yeah.
I've wondered for a while now about when the fundamental arhat is in meditative equipoise, and at some point the Buddha comes along and nudges them, but they've never made aspirations to mm-hmm. be of benefit to all sentient beings. And mm-hmm. yet, is it just this collision with the Buddha that they're bumped into the path?
Well, I think the Buddha would have to teach them. No, they actually have to go through and they have to meditate. Either on equalizing, exchanging self for others, or on the seven-point cause and effect instruction. It isn't that the Buddha wakes them and wowie, they have bodhicitta.
Yeah,
they have to go back. So they don't like instantaneously enter the path of accumulation of the bodhisattvas. They have to first generate bodhicitta.
Okay. And so what are the causes and conditions for the Buddha coming along and nudging them?
That I don't know. You have to ask a Buddha.
Okay.
I'm puzzling. I want to go back to the list of 12. There's one of those that the qualities that they get. How to think about they are able to live for 100 eons or 1,000 eons or, like, what is... Especially now that we're talking about emanations and stuff.
Yeah.
How do we relate to that?
That they can live for that long? Because in some god realms, they have very, very long lives. Maybe something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe if you're going to the hell realms, it's going to take a while to accomplish anything because they... Yeah. One thing, you know, why are we studying this? Why does Nagarjuna give us this? It helps us have the roadmap for how, you know, with certain markers to look for about what we will attain in the future. But it also... When we meditate on this and contemplate these qualities, it helps us in our refuge, especially our refuge of the Sangha. So when we're taking refuge in the Sangha, we're taking refuge in the Sangha jewel. So that has to be Arya beings. It's not even the bodhisattvas on path of accumulation and path of preparation. It has to be Aryas. And so when we study this, then we really begin to understand what the Sangha jewel is. So when we say, I take refuge in the Sangha, we have some understanding of it. Yeah. And so you can really see then how in the West, when they use the word Sangha to refer to a Buddhist, you know, the people who come to a Buddhist center, you can see how terribly misleading that is. Okay, in terms of, in terms of it being an assembly, yeah, maybe you could call it a sangha. But in terms of people saying that's who you take refuge in, you know, think of the qualities of those people in the Dharma Center and then the qualities of what we're studying here about the arhats. Yeah, who do you want to rely on for spiritual guidance? Yeah. So you see why, you know, the refuge is in the three jewels. Yeah, and a Buddhist community is a Buddhist community, but it's not the Sangha jewel that is an object of refuge. Yeah, but anyway, when we meditate on this, it really helps us when we say, I take refuge in the Sangha, because we know something more about the Sangha. Because usually we focus, okay, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. Yeah. Sangha, kind of skip over, you know? Yeah. But when you think, I mean, they're pretty outstanding, aren't they? Yeah. And so really trustworthy, these beings who you know, the arhats and so on, bodhisattvas, Buddhas, you know, who have these realizations, we can really trust them. And their guidance.
I was just wondering, at what point on each ground do they perfect? Like on the ninth, they perfect power. So, like, do they start the ground? Like, when do they perfect it on that path?
When do they perfect it on the path? I don't know if it's at the beginning of that particular ground or the end of the ground. I would imagine. It would be most of them, they would perfect it, many of them anyway, they would perfect it during the subsequent attainment, during the fifth and sixth ground, maybe, and tenth ground, maybe they perfected while they're in meditative equipoise.
I was just thinking, because then they have to accumulate so much more merit to go to be able to go to the next ground. So I was...
They accumulate merit not just by perfecting that particular perfecting, but gaining an unsurpassable perfection. That's not the only way they accumulate merit. They're manifesting bodies. They're still practicing all the other perfections. Okay, and they do that mostly in the time where they accumulate merit is in subsequent attainment.
When we talk about Manjushri and Chenrezig, Samantabhadra, which ground are these?
You mean Vajrapani?
No, these bodhisattvas, which grounds are these?
I have no idea.
They don't specifically tell us? Like...
No, they may in one sutra or another. And sometimes they're seen as bodhisattvas, sometimes they're seen as Buddhas. Yeah, so maybe you have to, you know, some sutras may tell you what ground they're on or where they are. I have no idea. Yeah. That's not the kind of question to ask me. I don't know these kind of things. Yeah.
The other thing is, too, that since I've been still transcribing these paths and grounds from your teaching 6 years ago, it has really helped me over the years to understand that their wish to benefit us is that no matter how we relate to them through the course of our lives when we meet them, that they will never abandon us. They will never think badly of us. They will never sort of say, screw you. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm going to go find somebody who's going to listen to me when I teach. That, yeah. And over countless eons, beginningless eons, we have met them. We have had relationships with them. We have received teachings from them. So after doing all this transcribing of these teachings, my confidence in knowing that they care about us and won't abandon us has really deepened for me. Mm-hmm. And that they're out there. We don't know who they are. So sometimes, just to have fun, I look at people, strangers, and whoever I see or who talks to me for even 5 minutes, I imagine, well, I don't know who they are. And you can really have fun with this. You know, you can really... And it has warmed up my relationship to strangers. It's warmed up my relationship to people I have difficulty with. You know, it's like, I don't know who they are. And if I've been meeting them since beginningless time, and they will never abandon me, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, it really deepens really your refuge in the Sangha. At least it has for me.
Yeah. And it stops the critical mind too, doesn't it? Yeah. You think, you know, I don't really know who this person is. Oh, but speaking about that, because... they always give that as a technique for not getting angry, is to think that they are a bodhisattva, which is very good to stop that critical mind and stop the anger. But you might get confused saying, then does that mean when I see, you know, one person killing another or attacking another, I think, well, you know, that's just Vajrapani and Yamantaka playing and not doing anything, you know, and so I shouldn't do anything. No, it doesn't mean that. You know, you still have to function according to appearances. Yeah, but if you think that they may be awakened beings, then at least you won't be angry at them. And that's the point of seeing them in that way. The point isn't that you just sit back and become totally passive because you don't want to interfere with, you know, Yamantaka's fantastic, you know, and Vajrapani, you know, doing something.